Okay, so it's Gordon Pinter and his Reel 3. And you were just talking about, you've just got to the regimental aid post, Gordon, and you're now realising the strength of the German force that was surrounding the chateau.
Yes. It was obvious that some mistake had been made with the strength of the attack that was sent. And I thought we'd done remarkably well. We'd surprised them, in other words, with the night attack. We'd shocked them. And I heard later, much after the war, that the Germans had been castigated for allowing us to get in so easy, you know. Mm. Anyway, there was at the regiment aid post, and it was there, strange enough, that obviously my jaw was broken, and I can hardly speak, and my mouth, the lip, upper lip is hanging off, all this terrible state. But nevertheless, a German reporter turned out, came up and asked me questions. And all I was able to do was write down the name and address and phone number of my wife. Strange enough, this actually was sent over the Lord Hawhawk program later on.
Oh,
and with the first intimation, Joan, that my wife had got that I was alive. Mm. And while I was at the aid post and getting treated, there was a friend of mine, Lance Corporal James. He'd been, I'm not sure whether his arm or his leg he was wounding him, but he was lying by the side of me. And he was always a very belligerent man at any time. And he was winding them up a bit. And I thought to myself, my God, I've got this far and I'm still alive and this bugger's going to get a shot, you know. And I remember it going like that towards him. But he was that kind of character, you know. I thought, you know, call them all sorts of names and everything. And anyway, from there onwards, I was then taken behind and put in a German ambulance. And a rickety old ambulance, and I didn't know where the hell I was going. But then we were taken on the road outside, and I was obviously going to a German prison hospital to get treatment. They signed language that thought to me. Well, I've never known such a nightmare ride in all my life. I suddenly realised what the Germans had withstood. The entire roads that I went on were pitted with shells all the way along, so the ambulance was going in these. You can imagine me on the stretcher being jolted on. Some of the Germans were in the ambulance too. Mm. And at the side of all the country roads, and these went on for miles, in fact I went on 100 miles, there wasn't a space on the side of the roads. There wasn't a German tank or a German vehicle destroyed. This had all been by aircraft, of course.
Yes.
One wondered how possibly an army could take so much casualty and still be able to fight.
Mm.
They must have had tremendous equipment. Yeah. There wasn't a space, that there wasn't a vehicle or a truck or anything. It was just one mass right the way along. And I went on through Calm, which incidentally hadn't been taken yet, and through Calm, and on through Falaise, which of course hadn't been taken, of course. And I went through Le Mans. I remember going through Le Mans. I could see through its window at the side there. And then we stopped at a place called Alencon. On the way, I think I was to be transferred to another ambulance. And I remember they stopped me by a cathedral. And they got me out and propped me up. I was very, very weak at this time. I got lots of blood, of course. And I was propped up against the cathedral wall. And I remember French civilians coming around, and although my uniform was completely bloody, they were reading South Lancashire on my shoulder until the other ambulance turned up. Then I waved it off again, and I think, I'm not sure the next place where I went to, but all I know is there was a huge bridge across the river there, and it'd been hit by bombers, and there it was in half, you know, it was hanging into the water. I thought, my God, how can we possibly hold out against this? But the way to hold out is you're not
But that journey that you described so well there, going through, and the sights you saw, you must have been in terrible pain as well.
Oh, shocking. Shocking. And some of the, one of the German nurses, there was two German dressed in army uniform, of course, gave me a drink of wine, and of course it just came back, and it's ridiculous. I had no thing on the top of the lip, was hanging off. Mm. It was practically just poured down. I was gagging and vomiting, in fact. I mean, there's no doubt about it, in a shocking state. I didn't think I'd survive.
Mm.
And then, you know, we went on, and another thing that was happening was guns were actually firing at us. Now, German ambulances have a big red cross right over them, not just like ours, right over the top and down the side, so it couldn't be mistaken.
Mm.
It just made me realise that what war was. I mean, there was guns. Mind you, we were probably going across the American sector then, but there was guns actually firing on this road where the ambulance was going.
Mm.
And every now and then, they'd stop the ambulance, the crew would jump out and get into the trenches that were dug at the side and leave us sitting in the ambulance on the road. And then another horrifying thing was a plane came down and was machine gun, you know, on the road. And this German ambulance was sad. I thought, I'm not going to live here, I'm going to get killed by my own side.
You weren't in a convoy of mixed vehicles?
No, this was just one ambulance.
One ambulance?
Yeah, and then we stopped at a place. Now, by now, my uniform had been so covered in blood that nobody knew whether it was a German or a British.
Yeah.
And they put me in this sort of temporary rest place. And it turned out to be a rest centre for the German Jürgen Division, which was the Hitler Youth. Well, they all knew that they were supposed to be absolutely ruthless. And I was there with me, one British in amongst these lads. I thought, my God, I'm going to get strangled here, you know. Anyhow, they were very good. They were very good, you know. The soldiers, the soldiers, sort of thing, infantrymen to infantrymen. Anyhow, from there, we went on and eventually arrived at a place called Rennes in the mouth of the Brittany Peninsula.
Yeah.
And this is where the Germans had their prison hospital. And I always remember, I just staggered. I remember, all I can remember was standing from the ambulance up the road, and a commando major who'd been a prisoner and wounded, only slightly, rushing towards me and sort of saying, God, what a state you're in. And he said, what the hell's happening to the South Lancashire? There have been so many casualties. And he brought me up to a coloured French. The hospital was staffed by French, even though it was, you know, it was a German hospital.
Mm.
And they got me down, I think, and all I remember was him coming with a huge syringe, and obviously he was putting morphine into me.
Yes.
And I remember nothing then until I was told I was out for 2 days when I came through. But the same major, when I came through, was pushing butter down through the side of my mouth because obviously I had no food at all. And that is the first thing. It was marvellous to me, this major. He was something. And I thought, this is keeping me alive.
Yes.
Well, it was a terrible place. You must remember, the Germans were in a massive trap themselves. So there was nowhere. They were not getting supplies through themselves, and it was hell in that prison hospital.
Mm.
But I always remember when I'm a boy, I'd watch this a picture called All Quiet on the Western Front, when the leading chap there was put in a ward of 12 beds, which was supposed to be the dying ward, and anybody that went in there sort of never come out. He eventually did come out, and he was shouting at the top of his voice. Well, can you imagine my horror one day when I was put in that type of ward where there's Americans and myself and a few more British, and they were put in this ward. And each morning when I woke up, there was two or three had gone.
Yeah.
And the chap next bed to me was I always remember the Texas chap. He was a wonderful chap, but he'd been terribly wounded in the stomach, and they had all sorts of tubes in. And we were supposed to, in my weak state, to try and make sure we kept him in. It was impossible, and he died one day.
Mm.
It was very sad that, because he was a smacking chap. But they were dying like that, and in the end, most of them had gone. And I was amazed to find,
like this chap
in this previous picture, that I survived. And the next thing we knew was a big, huge air raid on Rennes, American bombers. And three bombs hit the hospital, because they had a habit of the Americans, and when they sent their planes over, the lead plane dropped the bomb, and then they all dropped. That was their type of bombing, so of course it went anywhere. And three ones hit the hospital, luckily not my part. But after they passed over, it wasn't long before we heard that the Germans were pulling out. And there was all sorts of noise and things, and then all of a sudden we heard huge noise of tank engines. And I managed to get out, I was getting a bit strong, and I managed to get to one of the windows. And there was an amazing sight. It was coming up the main road, was this huge American tank division. And on one of the tanks, sitting on one of the tanks on the front by the gun, was General Patton.
Oh, you recognised him as Patton?
You couldn't miss him. He had a silver tank helmet and two silver Colt. He was a showman, of course. Mm. But he was a good showman for those sort of things. But the might they had with them, this was the Third Army coming through the end, was marvellous. Mm. And all the Germans had left behind with a company sort of just to look after us. I always remember there was a little sergeant major which he'd taken a great liking to. He was obviously well over really army age. He'd taken a great liking to him. When the American troops came in, he said, "Look after this man. He's been very good to us," which he did.
Yeah. But did they? You didn't have time to receive much treatment, it seems.
I'm sorry. There again. I regret the Germans were responsible for me speaking as I am now, because they were far advanced in the loop of the mouth treatment. In fact, when I eventually came back to England, all sorts of surgeons from all over the Allied world came to take photographs of what had happened.
Really?
I finished up with a sort of, how can I put it, like a rugby cage on, with wires coming out of sort of wing nuts down. It came down towards the side of my mouth and then went inwards on a sort of, like a sort of top roof that was pressing against. Anyhow, the point is that they did a job. If I hadn't have had this done in their hands, I was told later, I would have spoke like a man with a cleft palate.
Yes.
For the rest of my life.
Yes. Because you said earlier that you've got a false roof to your mouth.
It's done like a huge hole in there. Yeah. I still am an army pensioner, of course.
Yes.
And this was, they'd done that for me. Well, of course, they were French doctors, weren't they?
Yes.
It was a French doctor. I often wish after the war that they got his name, and, you know, but you don't think about it.
Years go past.
Anyhow, the Americans immediately then took us out of their town to a MASH type hospital. The outside, and this was heaven. I've never known anything like
it. Did you have this cage round your head at this stage?
Oh, I had it right the way through.
Right.
And it was a wonderful feeling, because this hospital is white sheets and all the treatment. Of course, Americans had everything. There's no doubt that they had everything. And I think it was a fair time. I couldn't eat them much at all, but they had white bread. We'd never seen white bread from the beginning of the war. Pure white bread, you know. And they were very, very good. I always recall there that one day they knew we'd had very little, the British, you know, and one day they backed up into a little grass square, three wagons, and they tipped them. And what it was a mountain of chocolates and cigarettes. It must have been about 12 foot high, the mountain. And they told us to give us boxes, cardboard boxes, and told us to fill them with whatever we want. Of course, the Americans would kill themselves back and forth, because they could get it at any time they wanted, and there was us all dived. I was then able to get on my feet and dive in amongst them, fill it with a box.
This was then at this MASH place?
This was at this MASH hospital.
Yeah.
Then, of course, there came the day when we were flown back in the Dakota to England. That was another nightmare thing. It was just the platforms on each side of the Dakota. And as it kept falling out of the air sort of thing,
yes.
Air pockets,
yes.
You know, it's a terrible nightmare drive. And we finished up in a hospital near Swindon.
Oh, right.
It was an RAF hospital.
Rawton.
I think it was that, yes. It must have been, because there was only one hospital there, RAF. And I remember when we got out, I was most surprised. You don't think you've done anything sort of thing, but I was most surprised. I still had this helmet on, and I was now in American uniform in the army, because we were so blood soaked the other that they'd take it off me and give me an American uniform, so God knows what we thought about it.
Well, you couldn't speak very much at that stage, could you?
No, you've done so. And there was me with my box under my hand, walking on this thing from the plane, with a crowd of people, all nurses and things, all clapping, you know. I thought it was some sort of hero, you know. But then, you know, I spent, this is where the photographs came in, where all the people came in at the Swindon Hospital. And I remember one time we allowed out in the countryside, and I went onto a platform. I walked along into the country, and I thought, my God, this is beautiful. With silence and everything, you know, and had birds singing. It seemed like heaven.
Mm.
Anyway, from there, we were put in a hospital train to go north. Now, the hospital train was all, windows were all covered. We didn't know where the hell they were going. And we went right through. And then, in the end, I managed to open it seemed a long time, we stopped, and opened a little part of the blind, and I saw, I'm sure they're Liverpool trams. And we'd come into one of the smaller stations in Liverpool that turned out to be Broad Green.
Mm.
And we were unloaded from there, and quite a lot of English soldiers then. And put on it got even better. We were put on the ambulances, of course, and I finished up at Smithdown Road Hospital. Now, Smithdown Road Hospital, my family home, is immediately opposite. Now, my mother didn't know I was alive, or didn't know I was what. So I have to scroll again on a piece of paper to a fine, and I think it was the Mouth Hospital, to go to 23 Edmonton Road, right after, and tell my mother, you know, but be
you're
careful,
there.
Be careful. And this evidently did, and I had my first minister, and all the others couldn't believe it, that I was having ministers half an hour after I got into the hospital. I was right in my own district, you know. It was unbelievable.
But your mother, when she saw you in this state, I mean, she was pleased to see you.
Well, perhaps in bed, you know, didn't recognize.
Pleased to see you, but then when she saw you like this, I mean, I can imagine the sort of sight you were then.
She been through it between my father.
With
the
father, yeah.
Wounded in the First World War.
Oh, right.
He'd been wounded and everything. My father, I'm being used to it. All my brothers in the army.
Mm.
I mean, it was an army family sort of thing, so she was pretty, you know, used to things, and she didn't take it. She immediately got in touch with my wife, who was at the RAF station at West Kirby, which is across on the Whittle from Liverpool, and sent a message across. And in the afternoon, in comes Joan in RAF uniform, and walked straight past my bed, couldn't recognise me.
No.
And one of the soldiers down at the bottom said that he's over there, you know, probably can't be over there. And she came and she must have had a terrible shock, you know.
Of course.
Because at that time, I mean, when you see me now, it's impossible to believe that. The disc was like a sort of that size, the hole. My lip was much longer, like yours, it covers my teeth.
Yes.
I lost quite a big strip out there. That was hanging off.
Mm.
And this side of my nose was all open.
Yeah.
All they'd done was stitch me, so I looked like a sort of gargoyle.
Yeah.
That had 160 stitches of that inside and out, so that's all they'd done before plastic surgery.
Mm.
So you can imagine what she thought of us. I suppose she thought, because we'd only been married in January that year.
Yes.
So she must have thought, well, we're married. And, you know, things from then onwards, I was having lots of plastic operations.
Yeah, but you're right now, because the tape doesn't see the pictures of you. But the way I would describe is that you can hardly tell that you've had that.
Well,
that
you
see those serious injuries.
You can see the things, and you can see the nose is out of alignment and certain things, but otherwise, the loop on my mouth, of course, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
I mean, they say,
Ah, yes, I see. Yeah. Just show me the roof of your mouth.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I say, from then onwards, it was just a matter of going in and out of hospitals, plastic operations in different places. They don't do them all in one hospital.
Mm.
And there's gaps in between. It's not like the Hollywood sort of thing. When you've lost skin and things like that, these things take a long time.
Mm.
And many times when you go in, they fail and you have to go back again.
Mm.
Now, one time I kept getting back to erysipelas, which is a very, very dangerous thing. Mm. It keeps repeating itself. And it did in my occasion, and I was on the death list at one time.
This was in Liverpool, the hospital.
Oh, and in the Manchester area.
Yeah.
Places, wherever there was a plastic unit.
When was this now? Around the end of 1944?
Well, this was in the end. This was towards the end of 44.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from then onwards, of course, I was just kept on a sort of holding battalion when I came out of these hospitals, or given long extended leaves, and that was my role was over, sort of.
When did you when did you come out of hospital then, Gordon?
Well, I was going in and out, you see, of different hospitals.
Yeah.
And I eventually came out when we decided there was more operation to be done.
Mm.
I should have had a stick put in on the top lip,
mm.
and I also should have had my nose straightened and this lobe put on.
Mm.
But John and I decided in the end, I'd gone through a lot, they'd had enough.
Yes.
And we signed, I signed myself out.
Yes.
And then I went back to the Holy Battalion and I was held there, so I was, I believed out the army.
Which was when, Gordon?
This was December 46.
December 46, yeah. Yeah. And then you go and you get demobbed suit or something, do you?
Yes, went across to Leeds.
What's the procedure of that? What happens?
Oh, gosh, we went across to Leeds. I think I was lucky because I was going practically on my own at that time, whereas most of them had gone huge batches. So I had a rather pick of the suits. I had a lovely some that boat together with it.
I'll look later.
It was quite a good suit, actually, and a mat. And a trilby, and I remember, and it was a horrible feeling, you know, I'd been an army man all my life, and although I was going a married person, I felt worse about having been married.
Mm.
I don't know what I'd have done, because I haven't had to come out of the army, which is
my
home, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember being on that train, coming back from Liverpool, from Leeds, and I felt as though I'd just rejected. That's the feeling I had, you know, just, you know, rejected. There's no more use to the army sort of thing. The war was still going on, of course, you know. I felt very... the war was finished then, of course. But I felt I'd have stayed on, of course.
Yes.
You know, my regiment after the war went to Palestine.
Yes.
You
would have stayed on and signed on and become a regular for...
Yes, that's what my intention
probably
was. Whether John would agree to it, yeah. I don't know, but that was my intention.
Mm.
If I hadn't ever been married after the war, I'd have gone on right on as a regular, you know.
So at that stage, feeling rejected because now you're not in the army, yeah. and you're still a young man.
Yeah.
Did you have any plans as to what you were going to do?
None at all. Just go down to an employment, you know.
Yeah.
Thing. And
yeah.
I went into the motor trade actually after that. You know, it just happened that I went to the place with Clodo with making brake lines for cars, and that's where I started, you know.
Mm.
And I finished up in the motor trade.
Yes.
In the end, I owned my own little business at the end, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And family?
Family, well, it was in... My first daughter was born in 1945. Then I had a son born in 47. Then there was a gap about 7 years, and the youngest son was born.
Mm.
That's my family, the three.
Yeah.
And that's my youngest son there with his family on the right here.
But your sons, no thoughts of army life for them?
Oh, I wouldn't. Strange enough, I guess, although I was so steeped in it myself, I wouldn't have recommended it for any of my family.
Yeah.
I would have gone against it for any of my family.
Mm.
Since it burned out of me, sort of thing, you know, understand me. And nor would my grandchildren, or whether that, you know. I'd try and talk them out of it.
Mm.
I had one grandson, actually, that was in the Paratroop Cadets, and he was wanting to go on, you know, but he would have done, but he got a thing called Petit Mal, which is a sort of... I don't know what the main disease is, but I don't think he ever had it. He fell off a boat in the water, and he'd gone underneath, and he'd had a bit of a fear, I think, and it brought this little Petit Mal thing on. And of course, he wouldn't allow him into the main army with that. So that put it out of it. Yeah.
Right, Gordon, what we'll do. That takes us up to present day, pretty much, doesn't it? And you're how old are you today, or now?
I'm 77 in November.
Yeah, 77. And if I might say so, looking remarkably well.
Thank you very much.
What we'll do now, we'll stop the tape, because that's that story. But I know earlier you said then there was some a bit of recapping you want to do. So we'll stop the tape, you can have a thought about that, and then we'll continue in a second.
Okay.
Right, Gordon. So that's you've gone through there on a sort of a chronological thing. You finished up end of the war and established your age now. But you've got lots of other thoughts now that you that are coming back, and you'd like to just to put on this tape, haven't you?
Yeah, I remember many incidents come back to me now, during the different actions, and one in especially when we happened to be in a war where I had. Found that I would more normally trenches were dug in loose soil, and there was a lot of rain in Normandy at that time, and a lot of them collapsed in inwards, and they were not very good defensive positions at all. But in this case, I was in a wood where it was clay, and we dug it. Although the trench is hard to dig in clay, it became very solid, and it was one where you could even dig sleeping quarters underneath at the bottom. You could sort of dig underneath it. So it was completely, what you call it, if you could call anything safe in those days, it was a safe trench. And this evening we were, it was a glorious evening, and we were, I and my other chap from the trench was lying on top of the a little hillock overlooking a sunken road. And it was about early evening, and we'd heard that the Royal Ulster Rifles, which was another regiment in the division, was coming through our positions to attack the German positions in front. And this happened, and we saw them coming through, and then all of a sudden a huge barrage from the Germans started, and obviously there was a dispersal of the Royal Ulster Rifles in front of us. But imagine my horror when I rushed back from a trench to get some sort of safety from the shelling, and found two Royal Ulster Rifles privates had made it in front of me, and were now telling me to go and find another trench after the lovely trench I'd dug. Yes. But these are the kind of instances that happen in war, and you just have to take it as it is. Many, many times trenches were dug and occupied, and then you moved on to somewhere else. Then there was another time, using this same trench incidentally, when there again we went out, I went out with a private, I was a corporal of course, and in my section we had a private who was a sniper, and we decided that there was a German position in front and we'd see if we could get anything of note, such as a senior officer. We went to the front of our tool, I should imagine about 10 or 15 yards from our trench, and through my binoculars I was able to see a senior German officer, obviously, in the trench. He's about, I should imagine, about 50, 60, 70 yards away, down below us. And I thought this would be a good thing to take him out. And this we decided to do. Keller had got, I don't know what was wrong with him at the time, but he was a bit short. And I grabbed hold of the rifle quickly, because you don't get much chance, and took an aim at this officer. And I could see through the rifle that hit him in the shoulder. But immediately they were alerted, of course, to where our position was. And they immediately informed their mortars, because the next minute there was dozens of mortars in the air. Yeah. And of course it meant a quick dive back to our trench and to get down and hope in God's name that none had landed in. Mm. Incidentally, they all landed around, by the way.
Yeah.
And this private that I was entrenched with was a confirmed atheist from pre-invasion. And I was just huddled down at the bottom, hoping in God's name that none of these mortar bombs would find its billet in our trench. And they were all round us. And to my horror, I saw Keller on his knees praying. And I thought to myself, my God. I said, of all the time he'd missed all the church parades, and there he was, he'd been kidnapped all the way along. But these kind of comical things sometimes happen. It's not all bad sort of thing.
Did he survive the war, that chap?
I don't know. He didn't. Mm. Obviously, he was B Company, and I know most of them that survived.
Yeah.
And Callaghan wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I often think some of the chaps I was with, you know, I always remember many years after the war, I often wondered who put the initial shell dressing on my face, because that, when I was wounded, because that was important, because it, as I just bled to death. And it was about 20 years after the war when I was at a petrol station one day, and obviously this Lance Corporal, who had been my Lance Corporal incidentally, drew up at the a garage where I was calling on, and we got talking, and I mentioned this to him, and he said, "Don't you remember Johnny," which was my name in the war, I was always called Johnny. And I said, "No," he said, "it was me." He said, "I was the one who put the first shell lifting on
all
the
right.
face."
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, then I had no idea, it was a complete shock. Oh, incidentally, it blinded me in one eye at the time with the shock of it, so I didn't know where the hell it was, you know.
Did you get your sight back in the other eye?
Oh, yes.
In the
right? Came back, yes.
Temporary.
It was just a shock. I think if it had gone a bit higher, like, I might have got the optic nerve, but I was lucky in that way. Incidentally, the bullet missed me tongue too, which is another thing, going through as it did. It could have easily taken my tongue, you know. Which,
oh, it was a bullet, not shrapnel.
Well, it was bullets.
Bullets.
Actually, one of my friends after the war told me that ICE always said it was one bullet. And he said, no, he said it was two. He'd see me, he said. The one that took your lip down there, he said, well...